Hello, FMA Plus community. This is Michael Carabin and Jesse Santiago, and today we are talking with Tuon Chess Yaco, founder of Pumahan Draubio Escrima. Tuon Chess is also the great-grandson of the legendary great-grandmaster Braulio Godoy, founder of Godoy School of Escrima. So sit back and listen as Tuon Chess talks about his system, his great-grandfather, and his views on the FMAs.
Tuon Chess, can you tell us about the history of the Pumahan Draubio style?
Okay. Well, with Pumahan Draubio, it's more of my family's expression of our foundation art, which is Draubio Escrima. Draubio was founded by my great-grandfather, great-grandmaster, Braulio Tomado Godoy. And just recently, a couple years ago, we felt that my family, the Siangco family, who my mom is the granddaughter of the great-grandmaster. So all the Filipino martial arts is on my mother's side. We thought that it was time for us to kind of move out on our own and express the art the way that we wanted to express it. The main school that we were founded on was the Godoy School of Escrima, my grandfather's school. But Pumahan is our way of my way of kind of giving homage back to my great-grandfather's experiences and with the man that he trained with for 11 years in the Philippines, which is who he has told us to be the general, Faustino Ablin, right. who was a rebel leader of the Pulahanes in the Dios movement in the early or the late 1800s, early 1900s, when they fought against the Spanish and the Americans. So in bringing Pumahan Draubio into our name and into our kind of mindset of how we train, how we teach, is really paying homage to their warrior spirit. They were known as kind of zealous, religious, but also extreme tacticians who were, you know, single bolo, you know, kind of running through the lines, going against gunfire, and, you know, ultimately getting to their enemy and finishing the kill and using their battlefield mentality and just real kind of rugged forcefulness in their art to do what they felt was needed to be done. So that's in bringing Pumahan into Draubio, just tying back to the history before my grandfather started the school in 1961.
Mm-hmm. Are there any major differences between Pumahan Draubio and Godoy?
I would say so. Like any other school, what Dolce Padre has gone through, what Kaju Kembo has gone through throughout the years, each instructor, when they are given the okay or the acknowledgement to go ahead and teach what you have, and everyone brings in their own experiences. So in Draubio, we have our foundation in what was taught to us by my grandfather and by Batikan Eduardo Godoy, his son.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and we have our own flavor. I tell this to when I do seminars, when I go out and talk to students and stuff like that. I always tell them, you know, FMA is like adobo, right? You go to your auntie's house, you go to your mom's house, they all cook it differently, right?
Right.
So that's how FMA is to me. It's a different flavor of our culture. You know, each person will bring a different flavor to the art. So I would say, you know, Draubio, outside of what we did with Godoy School of Escrima, you know, we're the first ones to open up with the family in the mainland. You know, we opened up in 1991. We held the San Diego branch of the Godoy School of Escrima for over 20 years, mm-hmm. until we moved on. And we have that foundation, you know, the foundation of my grandfather's, what he was known for, his counter for counter, his agaos, his grab art. We have that foundation. But with our background in, I also have extensive background in Kaju Kempo and Kempo. So we bring that intensity in the mano-mano. And with the boxing I have from my dad, from my dad's side, His grandfather was a welterweight champion in Hawaii who fought in the smoke clubs,
right.
In the 1930s, 1920s. So we did boxing our whole life. So with the weapons, you know, we put a lot of our own flavor in our kaju and stuff when we do our hand stuff. So a little bit more intense. Traditional or classical Draubio is mainly a defensive type of art. And as we progressed in our own style, we've been able to blend a more aggressive stance, a more aggressive nature within that defensive mindset. So I would say, you know, if you see my school and our home school, you'll see that sort of difference. But no, we're also Drobe. There's a handful of instructors actually moved away from the Bedore School of Escrima, and they have their own schools now, like Chief Dan Medina in Florida. We have Master Ron England in Hawaii. They started their own schools, their own systems. But we all have that foundation in the Bedore movement. So you'll definitely see Bedore, but you know, we take an angle a little bit differently. We follow through with our strikes a little differently, but it's still Bedore.
Right. So it was actually favored to kind of add your own, like you're using the adobo example, to add your own flavor to it. Like
Definitely,
for
definitely,
example,
definitely.
with Dan Medina in Florida, he has his own version of it also, but that's his own
Right,
flavor of it.
right. Yeah. With Dan Medina, you know, he has another. You know, he has Dos y Pares. His background is Dos y Pares and Black Sphinx Karate. So he has all those influences that blend into his Drobyo, and such as, you know, the other instructors. So, you definitely when you see us and see how we enter into our blocks, you can say, "Oh, that's Drobyo."
Right.
But when we follow through and go into a counter or a takedown, then you'll see little differences here and there.
Okay. Can you tell us what Pulahan de Robbio means?
The two words that came to me, this actually came to me one night, like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I had to jump out of bed and say, you know, this is what I want to name it. Pulahan means those who wear red. And that's who the Pulahanis were known for. You know, they would go into battle wearing red garb, because their mentality was, if I got shot and I didn't see the blood, I wouldn't think of being hurt. So they would be shot 5, 10 times and just still running down through the line because, you know, mentality, they're very into their anting anting and their amulets and their prayer. And a lot of it was very mental and spiritual. So their big thing was when they wear red and they would get hurt or cut, they would still continue into the fight. So that's the kind of fervor that we wanted into our system, that never die, never submit kind of attitude. And also the way my grandfather started our ranking system, it's a maturation from white, black, blue, and red. And red symbolizes a very high stature in our system. There's literally just a handful of people in the world that are registered in Drogo, generally. And so putting on that red shirt means a lot to a practitioner in our art. So in really symbolizing that in that name and that word within our title, within our namesake, you know, we wanted to put that honor into that name. And in tying that into Drobyo, there's several meanings that we have with Drobyo. Movement-wise, Drobyo means to be passive, to fight behind the power, more of a like of a Aikido kind of mindset. You know, passive aggression, you know, using the outside angles to isolate your opponent and work those movements. Drobyo also means the rhythm of the horse, and that's more literally translate rhythm of the horse. And the three main factors that we have in Drobyo is timing, rhythm, and fluidity. So when we first bring a student into our school and we start teaching them footwork, we have them bring into their mindset a horse in the different stages of their gallop, their stride, and their run, or their strut. There's always this rhythm and timing in how they move, and there's never a break in it from when they're walking to when they get up to a full gallop to a full run. There's always that constant rhythm, that constant movement, and that's what has always set Derovio apart from a lot of the older traditional styles, and especially the modern system nowadays, is our movement, our footwork. It's pivotal in being a Derovio practitioner. You gotta be able to move, gotta be able to circle your opponent. My grandfather was a sparring partner for Floro Villarreal in Hawaii. He used to train out in Hawaii. My grandfather used to train him for the death matches in Hawaii. And Grandmaster Villarreal was always, I have you as my sparring partner because it's like trying to catch a chicken in the hen because I can never touch you. I can never, because we're always constantly moving. And when people see us move, they always call us old style because that's the foundation of old school Arnis and Eskrima is your movement sets up the strike, your footwork sets up the kill. So that's always been our focus. So in putting Pulahan Dorobo together, using that attitude and that fervor of being a redshirt, being a Pulahan, and tying that into the movement of Dorobio, that was my main focus in bringing that into our namesake.
Actually, since you bring up about your great grandfather,
Sure.
did he ever tell you any stories about the death matches in Hawaii? Because they were pretty common up until I can't remember the year that it was outlawed, but they were pretty common back in the
Yeah,
day.
they're pretty common. He would most of the times he would tell us about training with his partners. He trained with you go down and you say my grandfather's name down in Hawaii, or if you see us wearing our patch, it's synonymous with Filipino martial arts in Hawaii. We're the first school to open up in 1961 to open up to non-Filipinos, and pretty much everyone that does or every instructor that has a school or has a group teaching out there has been influenced or has trained with my family. And when he would talk about training, it was always my grandfather's philosophy was if I needed to fight, it means to the death. So his big thing, he never put us into tournaments. He never wanted us to do those sort of things because the art was for survival. And that's just his background and growing up in Amandaue Mountain in Leyte, training with the general in fighting for a cause, fighting for a reason. So when that's why he never really, the only reason he would fight is if it was for death or for survival. So when he would talk about training with Villarreal and training the guys into the fights, he would train them outside of that venue. Because my grandfather was a very, very religious man, and he kind of saw that sort of matches as a waste of life. If someone did get hurt, they get killed. Because they're doing it for their namesake. They're doing it for pride rather than survival. But he loved everyone that he trained with. He trained them so they could survive. His main point of being a training partner for Villarreal was to keep him alive in his fights. That was his focus. That's how he would talk about it. And the main, we would always, I used to live next to them growing up in a concert hut in Waialua Road down in Hawaii. And when people come and train, we always talk about training in the banana patch down in the back of the houses or training behind that concert hut. And he would bring the old manongs down and they would just train and fight. And all these guys were in this, 60s and 70s and moving like they were 20-year-old kids. And that's what I remember when he would talk about the old days, fighting and the death matches. His real big thing of fighting was a reason to fight. And but he has very fond memories of being with all those guys, Villarreal, the Tobosas, all these families back home that, are synonymous with Filipino martial arts.
Hawaii really had a big scene in FMA. I know Hawaii and California, that's the main migration of Filipinos immigrating outside of the Philippines was pretty much Hawaii and California. And I know those were big scenes of FMA.
And how can you compare your memories growing up in Hawaii and how the FMA is now in the mainland? So if you could just fill us in on how things were then to now.
Definitely back in the old days of when my family was going through, my family was teaching, FMA was not a home name. It was always that kind of a fighting style. Or that's what the old guys do. That's what the Manongs do. You know, that's what the and you know, it was always about Kaju Kembo. It was always about Kempo. It was always about karate and judo, you know, in Hawaii. And because definitely in Hawaii, it was very much a word of mouth type of thing. You know, bringing in students, it was a friend of a friend, especially with the family teaching. You know, we would do seminars and stuff, but everyone that came into our system was by word of mouth. And a lot of that, and actually, my grandfather got a lot of flack when he first started teaching what we call haoles, you know, back then, no white people. You know, we were known as, when we first started, we were known as the haole school, you know, and people really looked down upon us. But my grandfather just had that kind of that mentality that, you know, this is something that is going to benefit everyone. And you know, he really had that vision of opening this up, you know, to those who really wanted it. And he would always tell people who questioned what he did was, yeah, but when you see my Haoles move, when you see my Haole boys move, they've moved Filipino. They're Pinoy in their movement. They, you know, I make them Pinoy. I make them Filipino. And that was his thing. But growing up, yeah, FMA was not a name. You know, people didn't know about Filipino martial arts. And back going into the 1920s, you know, the early migrations, you know, Filipinos were just known as, they were known as what's called a poke knife, you know, guys.
What
Now,
name?
every time, poke knife, like
Like
poke
poke?
someone.
Oh, poke, okay.
Yeah. So back then, you know, every time, like my whole family worked in the plantations, you know, they all had that experience in the plantation. And they say whenever an altercation would happen between race, like between Japanese or Filipino or Hawaiian, and you know, the Filipinos are the ones always pulling out their knives. And you always see them pulling out their cane knife or anything like that. So when as migration came through, Filipinos came into Hawaii and the fighting arts, people started seeing what Filipinos did and you know, knowing that they have something. You know, they know something. You know, they know how to fight, and they pull out that knife and they start to move. And so there was always that kind of mystifying kind of overview of, you know, what are these old Filipino guys know? You know, you see them, you know, training at night around the fire. You see them with their blades and that kind of mentality, you know, that secretive mentality of them training throughout the years really came through the generations. You know, keeping it secretive, or, you know, keeping it within themselves and bringing people that they wanted to bring in, you know, not commercializing themselves. You know, we never really commercialized our school. That's why we're so small right now. Even being the first school to open up in Hawaii, we're still a very small knit community of instructors and students, because of having that sort of mentality. And it definitely was, you know, you see a lot of politics nowadays between, you know, within own systems and people breaking off, and you see that politics now. I think it's getting a little better now, but back home in Hawaii, it was just everyone just trained with each other. You know, my grandfather was sort of a center point of FMA back then, and people would just come to the house and train. And the big
Regardless
thing
of
for my
style.
grandpa, yeah, different styles. You know, Villabrillo and him would always be together in training. The Tobosa family was one of the main families that started training with my grandfather. And, you know, they're from a Kali system. And so back then, you know, it was just, you know this, I know this, let's just get in the backyard and share and train. And back in Hawaii, that's how it was back then. You know, it's changed through then, you know, people moving on, people thinking they're this and they're that, and, you know, then the politics, you know, when everything starts to maturate and people start, the pride gets in the way. You know, there was never a sense of ego back then in Hawaii with training. And that's what, you my family has always brought into our teaching is and that's just from my grandfather's kind of standpoint from day one, is lose that pride, you know, bring in compassion to your heart, because what we're teaching can ultimately kill someone.
Right.
And if you bring in that ego, you bring in that pride, you know, hate also comes along with that. And knowing what you know, you can easily hurt someone. So everyone would come to him because he had that attitude, because he was so open and unloving. And our kind of a, it's not a, you know, Bible thumping kind of religious kind of thing, but it's just a spiritual thing that we really bring into our teaching, into our art, the creed that we follow. Because my grandfather did tie that into his philosophy in the art. And also because he was a Hilot man. You know, a lot of people
mm-hmm.
came to him for healing. So he really had that balance from being able to use an art for survival to kill,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, use that. But he balanced that out greatly with, you know, healing and being able to heal the body, heal the mind, heal the spirit. So there's a lot of that within Dorolio. And a lot of that, you know, we tie in to everything that we do.
Right. And I've always found that fascinating, you know, especially practitioners that also study Hilot or some kind of healing.
Right.
Or, you know, on one hand, you have the skills to, you know, absolutely take out your opponent and kill your opponent. And on the other
right.
hand, you also have the ability to heal and give life.
Right, definitely. And that's why a lot of the families would come to our home, you know, to the banana, what we call the banana patch, and train, because they knew if something happened, you know, grandpa would just, you know, come here, let me take my oil, let me rub you down. And, you know, growing up, every time we got sick, it was, okay, let's take a ride, let's walk over to grandpa's, you know, he's going to rub you down, you know, it's
mm-hmm.
going to be okay. And that's one thing I miss greatly. You know, when we moved away from Hawaii I didn't have that chance to have that connection with him anymore, and, you know, or have that teaching. He, you know, he didn't pass that on. He only passed it on to his son, Batikan.
Mm-hmm.
He only showed us a little bit of how to, you know, to massage and stuff like that. But his big thing was, in order to know the healing of Hilot, you also had to know the black art as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a balance in that. And he knew how to make lotions, and he used to have this long, in the old days, he used to have this long thumbnail, and he would make this numbing kind of lotion thing out of herbs and stuff, and he would have that inside his nail.
Mm-hmm.
So when he would grab someone and lock into a lock, he would cut that into their skin and actually numb them.
Oh, wow.
And that was the black art of Hilot.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something he never taught anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And he, it was something like, you know, and that's what was taught to him by the general. You know, in order to know, like myself, yin and yang, in order to know how to heal, you need to know how to break, right?
Mm-hmm.
You need to know. So he had that in his klima, and he also had that in his Hilot.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing that he had. But he had enormous, his power was just enormous. You could just see that. You walk into a room and you just feel him. I mean, at 90, before he passed away, at 90 years old, he was still doing karantas and taking people down.
Wow.
And his hands were just, you know, he was a small little Filipino guy, but his hands, he just touches you and you just feel power. What he would do in the old days, when he would massage you, he would tell you, okay, you're going to get hot now. I'm going to rub you, you're going to get hot. And then his hands would just get immensely hot. I mean, hot to the touch.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, he said, okay, I'm going to cool you down. And that spot would just get cold. So his unthink, his power was enormous. I mean, you hear that about Villabrio, and I mean, their training was intense. When my grandfather first migrated to Hawaii, he didn't want to deal with, working in the plantation and all that. So he lived in the mountains for 3 years on his own.
This was in Hawaii.
Yeah, in Hawaii. He went up into, he was on a big island, and he just went into the mountains and lived for 3 years, and then came back down and then decided to, just try out Hawaii.
So your grandfather learned Hilot from General Faustino?
Yes.
Amongst
yes.
other things?
Amongst other things.
Right.
His bulk of training, the way the story goes, where my grandfather made it into the mountains, and people always try to dispute, the same way where they dispute who Villarreal learned from the blind princess, and if you want to, you want to, but I understand what was taught to me, I embrace what was taught to me, so that's what I tell you. If you have speculations. Now, if you got a time machine and you can go back and doubt it, then do that. But you can't. So, but the way my grandfather has told us the story was, he grew up in a big family in Ormoc City, and he had an abusive father. So, at a young age of six, in 1905, 1906, and that's right around the time where the general Faustino. Was said to be arrested and escaped from prison,
right.
And was no longer found again. So around that time, my grandfather, at a young age, was like, I need to run away. I can't be in this place. So he left his home, came up to a fork in the road, and was either, do I go up into the mountains and hide and try? They heard stories about this general, this mystical man who could fight and do all these things, or do I go into the city with my friends and be one of those boys who, just running around, going crazy, not knowing what he's going to do in the city? So he decided to travel up to the mountains. So he traveled for about 3 to 4 days, and at night he would sleep up in the trees because they had, they have those huge ass freaking snakes and
right.
stuff, snakes that eat little boys, right? So. When he was traveling, he would sleep up in the trees, eat what he could, and then he came up to this clearing on the fourth, fifth day. He saw a little fire. It was at nighttime, so he's like, I don't know what this is. So he fell asleep over there. And in the morning, this old man comes out, and he's like, "Oi, boy, what are you doing here? No one has ever been able to find me. I've been hiding out in here for years, and What brought you to me?" And my for some reason, my grandfather was like, "You need to teach me how to fight.
Mm-hmm.
I was told, something brought me here to learn something from you." So from that day forth, my grandfather lived with what the man told him. His name was General Faustino Albuin.
Mm-hmm.
So he told my grandfather, "I'm a general of these rebels, and I've been hiding out from the Americans because I wouldn't bow down to their flag."
Right.
So the general that before I die, I need to pass down my knowledge. And for 11 years, that's all my grandfather did. Imagine being secluded with a master for 11 years.
And that's all you do.
Yeah, and that's all, that's your life, that's all you do. He trained you to, and my grandfather always say, the general had this power over nature. Like
mm-hmm.
animals would just come up to him and just kind of be with him, and nothing would ruin his crops. No bugs or anything would come into his crops. He just had this aura about it.
Mm-hmm.
So for 11 years they trained, and he would tell us stories about how the general would make him do all these things. There's this one he would tell us about to teach him faith. And the general had told my grandfather, "Okay, boy, go up into that tree, and I want you to jump into this water."
Mm-hmm.
So my grandfather goes up, and he looks down, and he sees something like spikes, like bamboo reeds sticking out of the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And so the general is like, "Boy, you need to jump off into the water, or you come down, and I'll kill you,
mm-hmm.
one or the other. But you jump with faith into those reeds, into those spikes, or you come down and I kill you." So my grandfather was like, let me just stay up here and pray for right?
Let me
let
think
me think
about that
about
for a
this.
while.
Right, calm down. So what he told us, like, he just prayed and he prayed and he just closed his eyes and he jumped, thinking, I'm gonna die. There's spikes in these, well, I'm gonna die. And then when he got down, he jumped into the water and he survived. And all he could see in the water were these reeds lying around him. And from that day on, he knew within his faith, if I just pray and put my heart into my prayer, I would be safe. And that's what the general is trying to teach him.
Right.
Pray your prayer. You know, give your heart to God or to what you believe in, and it'll bring you through. So from that day on, you know, that religious type of belief was put into my grandfather, and he brought that on. So he would tell us a lot of stories like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, oh, good thing we don't train like that tomorrow, huh, Lolo?
A lot of liability
but,
now.
Yeah.
Can you tell us when General Faustino felt that it was time for your grandfather to leave? That they had a, what do you want to call it, almost his promotion or his test?
Oh, yeah, for my grandfather, around 17, 18, the general said, it's time for you to leave. I need you to go. I need you to pass on what I taught you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I need you to go out throughout the Philippines. I need you to travel. I need you to test what I taught you. I need you to get challenged. I need you to learn. So at 17, he said, it's time for you to kill me. It's time for you to fight. It's time to become a master. So his test was, my grandfather says, it felt like a long, long time. It was like maybe around 2 hours where they were just beating and moving. And traditionally, classically, Dorogo is a single bolo, live empty hand art. That's our foundation. You know, we don't do a lot of duplicata or double stick kind of stuff. We don't do a lot of espadilla. We do that now in our training because in order to defend against something, you need to know how to fight it. So we train those other kind of tactics in terms of defense, to let know the defense. But classically, traditionally, we're a single bolo live hand art. So he said he fought for about 2 hours. And Dorogo is a lot of baiting, a lot of engaño, and a lot of movement. So it's just, if you see real mature fighting chickens going at it, you know, they enter, they bait, they hit and move, they hit and move, hit and move. So the whole fighting was like that. Throughout the 2 hours, the general was not scathed. He wasn't cut. He wasn't harmed. On the other hand, my grandfather only suffered a cut to his bridge of his nose and to his chin, which he had, which he would always talk about, because people would ask him, oh, Grandpa, where'd you get that scar? And that's the only, and they were fighting to the death. So as 2 hours came along, and, you know, General was like, it's done. You know, you've learned the art. I tried 100% to try and kill you.
Right.
You did the same, and we've survived. So at that point, he called him a master, and he told him to go into the town, to move and to travel and do your travels. I could just imagine what that fight would have been like. You know, a lot of, and for Dorobio, we're very much patient fighters. You know, that's why we're not. My grandfather never wanted us to go into tournaments because we were trained to wait and wait. We could do our sparring matches. You know, it'll be 10, 15 minutes where we're just moving around and baiting and not even one strike would leave our hands because, you know, we're using that kind of psyche of, you know, okay, you move and you're done.
Right.
That's a little reminder, you know, wait and move. And if nothing comes at me, there's no fight. No, why fight if there's no action? Right? If there's no intent in my opponent's heart or mind to hurt me, why am I going to bait into that fight? So we're definitely not a tournament-minded system. know, we're very much a survival system. You know, battlefield and this the time is there. The time is there. If it's not, then there's no use of force. So just to think what that fight would have been like, just feeding that blade out and retracting and moving, and I could just envision that, and it would have been awesome. Because when I used to fight far against my grandfather, it was into, and he was like, when he first started teaching me, he was in his 60s. And seeing him move at 60, oh my God, imagine what it was like in his prime.
Right. So,
but after those, that 2 hour fight, he actually went back home, and that's where the legend of my grandfather came to build his legend of his compassion. He first went home and met up with his father again. And what has happened was, what he told us was, my father picked up a stick and tried to beat me. And as soon as he swung, I disarmed him, put him to the ground, held him down, and said, I'm no longer your son. You're no longer going to hurt me. And all I did was to come home and tell you I was alive. And then he left. And he traveled to the Philippines from Leyte all the way down south to Mindanao throughout, and met a lot of different styles, a lot of different fighters. And there's one, he became a bodyguard of this datu in one of these villages. And back in those old days, it was, you know, village versus village. It wasn't to go crazy and have everyone fight. It was, I send my fighter, I send my number one, you send your number one, and we'll dispute whether I own this land or I own this cow or what have you, right? So my grandfather's traveling to town. It was in this village, and there was this stuff going on, and the doctor asked him, I need you to fight for me. I need you to settle a score. So he went into this fight, and my grandfather got into the fight, countered, and was about to kill him. And so his thing was, you know, they knowing that our whole purpose in our art is we're empowered with skill and power to do harm, to do death. But we are not God. You know, we cannot resurrect life. So why is it in us to take a life? We have no right to take a life. So at that point when, you know, the villagers were kill, 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 he dropped his blade and told the man to go on his way. And after that, he was known as this compassionate fighter that could kill you at will.
Right.
But he chose to give you life. And that's what we're bringing, that's our mindset in bringing it into a fight, is when I come into a fight, I'm bringing you your life. Because I know I can take it at any minute. So when we get altercation, we train people to, the style of fighting is to bridge between engagement from largo to corto. And our main combative stage is at corto. That's where we are at our strongest. That's where our kana comes into play. So our whole fighting base is to get into a controlled corto position on half the man, we call half the man. We isolate the weapon where we can kind of control the situation and tell the guy, I can continue and kill you, or I can let you go with a broken arm. Where do you want it to go?
So showing the compassionate side again, because you're just basically just disabling your opponent without having taken any further than that.
Right. Yeah, it's always a progression. You know, we start off is we open the gates. My grandfather, when you enter into a fight, you open the gates. You know, if a hand comes out, you break the wrist. You hit the hand, disable the hand. If he continues further, you go into the elbow. If he continues more, you go into the shoulder. You go into the hip, you go into the knee, you go into the body, you take the guy down. Okay, if you still continue as a broken man, you know, there's no need to fight. He's broken. He's done. But if you know, we still have that mentality that if at the 11th hour you're going to be killed, you know, we can counter that with that as well, you know.
So how is Pulahan Robio doing?
I think we're doing great. You know, when we first broke away from, because what happened was my uncle taking over the school, you know, as grandmaster, and you know, I have no hard feelings. I know his main thing was bringing the school into a new era, kind of commercializing it and making a business out of it, because he's a businessman. He's a highly respectable businessman. I understand that from him. He's my mother's only brother, you know, and I love him. He's my godfather. But you know, my family, my mom's, you know, the fiancos, we always have that backyard mentality. You know, we always have that train out of your garage, train people, because when we bring people in, is you come if you want to train me, you come to my house, you eat dinner. And we can talk, yeah. And that's old school. You know, if you want to train with me, you give me a call. No, I'll cook you dinner. We sit down, and I find out what's in your heart. If you want to train the art for the art, for understanding the art, then I'm gonna give this to you. But if you come in and you ask me, oh, I want to be a knife fighter, or I want to be able to do this or do that, then you're not coming in with the right mentality. If you come to me saying, no, I love your art. I love your philosophy. You know, I want to start from day one and just immerse myself. Then that's the person I want. It's never been about quantity for us. You know, my family been teaching out of San Diego since 1991, and I've been training since I was 3 years old. It's always been about the quality in the student, the quality in their heart, and what they're doing. You know, I would rather have one awesome student that does the art the way I was taught than have 200 ridiculous looking black belts or what have you. You know, just doing crap, you
Right.
know?